You're listening to The Soul Chronicles, the podcast navigating life and times in the sneaker industry, Hollywood, and corporate America.
Hi, welcome everyone to season two of The Soul Chronicles. We are so excited to be back. We have so many more amazing stories, more interviews with amazing people who are working in the sneakers, sports, and entertainment industries. And just, of course, Nikita and I's stories and our journey working in the industries, bringing you our Soul Chronicles. My name is Mohammeda El-Muhajir, along with my co-host.
Hi, I'm Nikita Newell-Hall.
And together, we are the hosts of the Soul Chronicles. So on today's episode, we are bringing to our show Sean O'Shea. And Nikita, I think you're going to do the introduction for Sean.
Yeah, I could not think of a better way to kick off season two of the Soul Chronicles, chronicling our journey in the sneaker industry, without bringing on an amazing sneaker designer. Like, to me, that's just the best way to kick off season two. I met Sean during our work at GBMI, but our paths have crossed. Just looking at his very illustrious, impressive resume. He has designed for brands like Nike, for Puma, for Adidas, and also for Converse and several other brands that he will tell us about himself. You know, Sean grew up in Boston, which is interesting to me. And he currently lives in Santa Barbara and works around the Santa Monica, so SoCal area. So ladies and gentlemen, those of you out there in sneaker land, please welcome to our show, Mr. Sean O'Shea.
Woo!
Hey, Nikita. Hey, Mohammed. How's it going?
Oh, Sean, great. Like, where have you not worked? Sean, where have you not worked?
Right. He's got so many brands on his resume. Like, I was like, wow. Guess, Tommy Hilfiger, Pony, Diesel. I mean, just everything, everywhere, everybody.
Yeah. I've worked a lot of places. I love it.
So Sean, I mean, I think what our audience probably wants to know more than anything, an African-American man, sneaker designer extraordinaire, how did you get in? How did you land this dream job?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really good question. I would say when I got into it, obviously it was in the, I'm a little bit older. So it was in the like mid to early 90s. I didn't even know it was a profession. You know, I was a basketball player. I was hip hop culture. You know, I got a scholarship in basketball, went and played basketball, but was going to art school and kind of didn't know how to combine the two. So I actually graduated from college after playing basketball and kind of didn't know what to do. Got a job at Foot Locker, was lifeguarding. And then I thought, okay, I'll go to architecture school because at least I can tap into the art side of my, you know, my talents, I guess. And as I was doing research for that, I actually bumped into a guy who was like, you know, I've been listening to you talk to my architect friend here, but I think you need to study product design. And, you know, and I was like, what's product design? And he was like, you can design anything from furniture to cars to, you know, sneakers. And I was like, hold up, you know.
Did you say sneakers?
Yeah, I was like, someone designed sneakers? You know, I was like, that is, you know, okay. I'm in my 20s, like early 20s, and I can't believe I just heard of this. So yeah, that moment for me, I literally put my portfolio together, applied to art school in Boston. And, you know, I did like 3.5 years of a second undergrad because I was like, I'm designing sneakers. Like, that's the coolest thing I've ever heard of. And then I think when I was in art school, at the time, there were not many athletes, I think, designing shoes. It was like, you got these art students in art school, not athletes. So, you know, when the companies came to our art school, you know, they have this 6'4", you know, light skinned black guy over here designing sneakers. They were like, I basically got recruited. I was like, I always said, I was like a NBA top recruit for sneakers. Like, I had, you know, Reebok, I had all the different companies kind of hit me up and offer me jobs before I even graduated.
So they were like, who is this guy? We want him. We don't even know. We don't need to see the portfolio. We want him.
Well, no one else even had sneakers. At the time, it wasn't cool to design sneakers. So everyone was designing products, you know, like anything from, you know, like I said, furniture, you name it. But I had, my portfolio was all sneakers. I was like, I'm doing sneakers. Like, I don't even care about this other stuff. So I think it was like a home run. Like, oh, this guy, you know, so I just knew what I wanted to do. As soon as I heard of it, I knew what it was. So it was, I think it was destined, you know, to happen. So I think that hyper focus on it was kind of easy. It wasn't like they had to mold me into it, or I didn't have to, like, you know, I didn't have to knock on doors. Like, even though I did, I found places. Like Puma was in Brockton, Massachusetts. And I remember walking into that building one day when I was just walking by, and I just walked up to the poor girl at the reception desk and was like, you know, this is Puma. I want to design sneakers.
I love it.
And she was like, yeah. She was like, okay. You know, kicked me out of the building very, very politely. But yeah.
Wow. So tell us about your first job. Yeah. And was it what you expected?
Okay. So I interned at Reebok back when Reebok was like on top of it. I think they had a year there where they were number one ahead of Nike, or going back and forth. So I got to intern there, and that was pretty awesome. Yeah, worked with some really talented people. And then I think I interned at New Balance. So I think it was reverse. I first did New Balance, then I did Reebok, and then my first job was Converse. I would say I was too young in the game to really know what was happening. And I was only at Converse for a year because that's when Converse got closed down, laid off all their people pretty much, and then got sold. And at first I went to one group and then another group. So I was only there for a year and I got caught up in those layoffs. But then I went to Adidas. So I would say I was only at Adidas for like 2 years, but that was my first. I was so excited to go to Adidas because all I could think about was like hip hop culture. You know, I was like, I'm going to be hanging out with Run DMC and it's going to be this, you know, all hip hop culture, everything I kind of grew up with. I was like, here we go. And I got there and it was nothing what I anticipated. I was highly disappointed.
Were they in Oregon at that time?
They were in Oregon. Yeah, they were at the Janssen building, not even on campus. So they were across the street, it was a nice building. Everybody was really nice, and they were, but I would just say they, I don't know why, but at that moment in time, they weren't hyper-focused on kind of the culture side of it. It was more hyper-focused on the performance side. Like, that's when Kobe was there. So I was there when they did that, the one Kobe shoe or two Kobe shoes that happened. But yeah, that was kind of, but it was not, there was no embracing of the culture of, it was just like technical. Mm-hmm. Shoes, very corporate. I was kind of, I would say I was disappointed being there. And that's when I left and went to GBMI and met you, Nikita.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So yeah. Oregon definitely is not Hollis, Queens. Like, not the same.
No. No.
I don't,
no,
do not, I think you're going to be bumping in the Run, D, M, or C.
At the early days of a shoe designer, like, what are you doing at the beginning? I mean, are you finishing designs, working on design? Like, what are you doing at the beginning?
Well, I probably should have been finishing designs and learning how to do that side of it, I think. But when they brought me in, I think they were, I kind of stood out. So they teamed me up really quickly. Like, my first project I worked with at Converse was Master P. So, I mean, I was not talented enough. I knew how to execute or do anything as a designer at the time, but they were like, you know, we got this, they look like they should be together.
Right.
So they teamed me up with Master P, and I was working on his shoe. My shoe never released because the company shut down. Mm. But yeah, that was like my first project. So I've been lucky. I've gotten good projects every step of the way. I've never really, you know, I like to say it's because of my talent level, but there's a lot of talented designers out there. I would say, it was a combination of things. It would, you know, being the only maybe athlete, kind of looking the way I looked, being Black, to be honest with you, mm-hmm. I think actually helped me. Mm-hmm. You know, the funny thing is, we always talk about getting in the industry. I wanted to be at Adidas so bad that a headhunter set me up for an interview. And I don't know if at the time, you know, this was back in the day, we had portfolios in these huge portfolio cases.
Black,
it was like a 2 foot by like, maybe 2 feet high, maybe 3 feet high by like 4 or 5 feet. It had a handle on top.
Right.
So I went in with my portfolio and into the interview, and a headhunter set me up, and he's like, I got a position for you at Adidas, you know? So I had to drive all the way up there from, I had moved to California, just to San Diego when Converse had the layoffs. They gave me like $2,000 as a severance package. And I was like, I'm moving to California with $2,000, you know? And then the headhunter called me and, right, sleeping in my car.
Yes.
But then I got a call for Adidas, so I jumped in the car and just drove straight up to Adidas up in Oregon, which I don't even know how long that took me, like maybe like 18 hours. But I got to the interview, went right into the interview, and I was sitting there, and I realized after about the third person came in and was interviewing, no one asked about my portfolio, which was down by my leg, and I realized I'm interviewing for a product line manager position, not a designer position.
Oh, wow.
And I wanted to be in Adidas so bad, because all I could think of it was like, you know, it was like working at Bad Boy or working at, it was like, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to be working in this cultural like center. So I just pushed my portfolio underneath the table. And I was just like, I'm going to own this. I'm going to go for a product line manager. So point being, for the first year at Adidas, I was actually a product line manager. And yeah, I did help out with the Kobe Bryant project, but from the, I'd say from the product line, like the, you know, the marketing, not the marketing, not like the marketing you guys do, but from the product line manager part. So if you know how footwear is set up, it's like a triad. You have the developer who works with the factories and helps to make your shoe. You have the designer who is like the artist and they create the shoe for the customer, you know, draws it up. But then you have the product line manager who, this guy is responsible for the business side. They work with the salesman and they create the structure of what the entire line should look like, say the basketball line, because I was in the basketball category. So we wrote the briefs and did all that. So for a year I did that and in basketball at Adidas until they moved me in. But I did work on the Kobe Bryant project at the time. Yeah, long-winded answer, yes, but not from the design standpoint.
That's
brilliant. And I think, you know, being a PLM first to me just demonstrates that sort of grit that people really do need to have when they want to break into some of these coveted industries. And that's really just say yes to whatever presented to you.
Right.
Just be willing to get in and tell yourself, I am going to leverage this as best I can once I get in. And I believe that being that PLM, you know, once you became the designer, I bet PLMs loved working with you because they knew that you, you know, had come from where they currently are. And just, I think it was just better for that triad that you had been, you know, on that PLM step before becoming a designer. So,
yeah, I think it definitely helped me at Adidas at being a designer afterwards, helped me kind of flip my mindset to think about the business side. But then when I went to GBMI, where I was with you, we didn't have PLMs. So the designers had to be PLMs also. So that really helped me. Okay. We're a business. We're just not artists. Like, we need to structure a line. We need to think about how much money we make. We need to design shoes that, you know, that build an entire line. Because, you know, you put five designers together with no business management, we're going to just draw whatever we want to draw. Just do dope shit, you know. Yeah, so I didn't mean to cut you off, Nikita.
No, that's perfect. No, that's exactly what I want to hear. But that kind of brings us to GBMI, Global Brand Marketing, Inc. It was a global footwear licensee based in Santa Barbara. And that is where I first met you, Sean, and where Mohammeda, you later came to work with us as well. And the footwear licensee is a very interesting role. I knew nothing about the licensing business before joining GBMI and subsequently was able to learn a lot. And one thing that experience gave me the opportunity to do, and Sean, I want to hear if it was the same for you, but it gave me the opportunity to work across a lot of different brands because they did hold the license for Diesel, for Nautica, for XOXO, and then they bought the Pony brand. And I think they also held the license for 7 for All Mankind, just a bunch of different brands. So basically what that meant is just under one roof. I was on the celebrity entertainment side, but I was able to rep sort of all these brands. Did you design for multiple brands there, or were you just on one brand?
So I was brought in originally from Mecca. I don't know if you guys remember Mecca back
in the day. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, so I was actually really excited. I mean, I was leaving Adidas to go to a licensee from Mecca, which, you know, now in hindsight, I'm like, that doesn't even make any sense. But
at the time, Mecca was hot, let's be clear.
Mecca was hot, and I wanted to be part of the culture. So that seemed like deeper into the culture, not, you know, the opposite direction, like more corporate angle. So I was like super excited to work for Mecca. But then I saw all these, that was my first exposure to, you know, we had all these international designers. So I got to see like what was happening in Diesel and all these different brands, like High Heels with XOXO and 7 for All Mankind. So I did. I got so drawn. We had an Italian brand, Dry Shot. So I got so excited about it. Yeah, I absolutely, after the Mecca thing kind of fizzled out, I jumped all over the place inside of that company just to experience making shoes. You know, from a designer standpoint, you draw something and then someone makes it. So you want to have all these different people make your, you know, like this person's an expertise in Italy, at their factories and they make shoes differently. So I was like, I want my sneakers to have that quality of an Italian made shoe. I want to see what it looks like when I draw a high heel. I want to see. Yeah. So I did. I got to draw a lot of different shoes while I was there. And that was really exciting.
Wow. I love that.
How did that work? I mean, were you just on a big design team or were you able just to submit designs for some of the different brands? What was the structure like for the designer?
Great question. So we were actually very brand oriented. So like, the owner at the time, Killick Dada, I don't know if you remember him, Nikita. Yes, he wanted the he wanted the product departments to be very segmented. So, you know, like when he walked in the Mecca room, he wanted to hear hip hop playing. He wanted you to really embrace the culture of that, you know, which is a dream for me. We brought in, you know, we had a kid do some graffiti in there. We, you know, it was only playing hip hop all day. So we were segmented. But then sometimes what they do is they'd pull you out for specific projects or we get moved around. So sometimes there would be a need in another brand. So they would ask you, you know, do you want to go design for Diesel for this season or permanently, or do you want to go? But I personally got pulled out a lot for just projects because I think I was kind of doing some, I think I was really inspired by all the other brands. So for what Mecca was expected of at the time, which was just traditional cut soles and, you know, like Air Force One looking shoes. Mm-hmm. I was doing all these crazy looking shoes that they did not anticipate. So I think they were like, oh, his head works a little bit differently. Let's see what he can do in Nautica or what he could do in Diesel or what he could do over here. So I got pulled up a project here and there, which was very, very exciting.
Okay. Yeah, Diesel Footwear was so successful. I mean, I loved all of the designs that they came out of that group, particularly the more sneaker inspired footwear. Right. And I do believe that was a very, very profitable segment of the business.
I don't know if we have time, but before we get there, I wanted to talk a little bit about our relationship with GBMI, how you guys set up the whole Snoop thing and the Diddy thing. Like, that stuff was amazing to me, how you guys set that all up.
Let's talk about that for sure.
Did you listen to the Snoop episode, Sean?
I did. That was amazing. That was hilarious. I didn't know, Nikita. I didn't know that was your first time getting high. It was with Snoop.
Sean, let me just tell you, sir. I was so high out of my mind. I didn't know if I was coming or going. And what I also didn't know is that getting a contact high could make you as paranoid as if you just smoked it yourself. So not only was I, A, high for the first time, B, so hella paranoid, like, know I'm high? Do they know I'm high for the first time? If I get in the car to drive home, am I gonna get pulled over?
Right.
Am I talking right? Right? I don't know, like, you know, because my job was to sort of facilitate your role as designer and your other design team. Who else was there with us? It was you, was Gatling with us?
So Gatling is in he just recently passed, but Gatling was a developer. Good guy. So David Gatling was in the, he was on the development side. Yeah, he was there through all of this. He was great. And then Ron Wright was the other side. So he was my boss at the time. Ron came from Adidas with me.
I got it. So Ron Wright's a really wonderful designer. I think he's over at Nike now. Right. Dave Gatling was a development guy. When I tell you the funniest dude you will run across, he would always have the funniest one-liners. And he was one of these guys who, you know, it is difficult being African American working in the sneaker industry. And I don't want to run past that. I want to tell the truth about that.
Right,
and he was one of those guys who was never for the BS. Like, he just wasn't with it. He just was like, this is stupid and I don't care. And so one thing that you could always count on David Gatling for, that's just to keep it all the way real. So I definitely want to acknowledge him, you know, in this moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, so me, you, Gatling, Ron Wright, Snoop Dogg, and all the antics that come with a Snoop Dogg house. But we were able to pull together, I think, some really interesting designs. And, you know, you did really take his vision, because he did come with a vision, right? It wasn't just like you could just run off and design whatever you wanted for Snoop.
Right.
He did have a vision for what he wanted to bring to life. Can you talk to me a little bit about what that process is like when you're working with a celebrity designing a sneaker for them? What goes into that?
you know, that is probably, in my opinion, that's probably the question most young designers want to hear about, because that's the unique experience they all kind of dream about. But yeah, no, it's Snoop in particular. So let me say this at first. The first collection, like you guys had talked about in the other podcast about the box that was designed, and Muhammad, you were part of the collection that basically sold out in like 3 days or something, the 5,000 shoes that blew out. That was more Ron Wright and those guys. They took the lead on that, and I kind of came in on the back end. So I'm not going to sit here. I want to make sure those guys get credit for the work they did, because they did an amazing job. Then Ron left and went to, I think he went to Nike. So I ended up taking on his role. So I was more the guy in the background helping. And then I got to kind of come in and really take on the responsibility of working with Snoop after Ron and those guys had handled that part of it. Okay. So I just want to make sure I acknowledge that. So So then, but then the part I get to do is I get to work with, and I will say, this is, of all the companies I've worked at, like how you guys set it up was a dream. Like I thought this was how it was supposed to be. So traditionally, like with most companies, they set up like a 15-minute window for you to, with all the marketing guys and some weird, you know, location where you walk in and you're waiting for the entertainer and you get like 15 minutes and you have like 10 questions you ask. And they answer the 10 questions and then you're out. They shuffle you out. And that's all you get with the entertainer, which I've always thought was ridiculous. I don't think people, it just doesn't make any sense. Because if I was the, whoever that partner was, if I was Snoop or one of these guys, to have someone design your shoes, that's a dream come true. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm going to have my own. So I want to spend time with the designers. So that's what you guys set up is we had this, like, and I heard you guys talking about that earlier, about like one of the things that you really appreciated was how some of your bosses would leave, would let you really interact with anybody at Nike, or like you guys got the free pass and some managers didn't. They cut that off for you guys. And that was you know, that was kind of like the death of your, so when you guys, like that's the balance that we deal with a lot, but at GBMI and dealing with you guys and how you guys brought in Snoop and Diddy, it was a completely open like situation where Snoop would just call us and we would just go meet him wherever he wanted to meet. Like we would just go sit with him. If he had an idea and he was at a mall, he would be like, yo, come meet me at this mall. I want to show you some sneakers. And so it was like a really cool working relationship where like it seemed like he enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed it. So, I mean, it was like anytime him and Diddy, I mean, Diddy was the same thing. So he would just call us and we would just, we'd meet him anywhere. We met Jeff Dees and I met him at an airport one day. We were everywhere with these guys. Like it was really a great relationship where we felt like we were drawing what their vision was of what the line could look like of shoes.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think for Muhammad and I mean, whenever we seek to build something with celebrities and with our colleagues, you know, we want it to be special and we want it to be authentic. And plus we just have good common sense. I mean, there's no way you're expected to get the look, the feel, the energy, the kind of ethos of a person in a 15-minute conversation.
Right.
And I think that's why when you work with some companies and when you see some brands who just sort of come in and want to pimp the hip hop culture, they kind of end up with the kind of product and they end up with some of the marketing campaigns that they end up with because there's no heart and soul in it.
Right.
And so for us, I know I'm speaking for Muhammad too, and I want you to jump in. But for me, it just makes sense for me to put you. First of all, there's so much groundwork that even goes into it before you even get in front of the celebrity.
Right.
I mean, there's so much that we're doing behind the scenes to massage the situation so that when the celebrity does show up, that they're in the right kind of frame of mind, right? Mm-hmm. And that when you show up, we've prepped you. You know what it is and what it is and what to do, what not to do, how to da-da-da, right? That when we all come together, it just seems like, oh, this is just so smooth. But really, Muhammad and I have been working behind the scenes just mitigating all the possible risk factors so that it can be smooth and that we can have an end result that we're all very proud of. And like these many years later, we can stand behind and say, oh, we did that. And so, yeah, that Snoop product was really special and it was fun. Muhammad, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, I did want to add, and I think that, you know, just some brands don't always have people on staff who have those kind of close relationships with the artists, and then you can see the difference. You know, Sean, like you said, like, you know, if it's just very corporate and they don't have like an in-house point person managing that relationship, you will get the 15 minutes, right? You know, the artist is not having it. They're just like, yeah, I'm coming in and I'm out. But if you have people on the team, the brand side, who know them very well, who, you know, as you said, Nikita, can kind of sort of like manage and massage that relationship, it gives the designers, you know, that much more access to them. So I think you saw that firsthand, Sean.
Yeah, well, let me jump in, because I'll say I actually use you two as an example and any other assets I've worked with since then, because those relationships and the way you guys curated the designers, my ability to work with them, it was perfect. It was literally, it was exactly what, like, I think everybody would think is happening behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And I have never experienced it like that again. I don't know what you guys, if it was your prior relationships or your understanding of it or whatever it may have been, but it was literally seamless. Like, there was no jumping through the normal corporate hoops mm-hmm. that you have to. It was like, you guys just provided this atmosphere that was like, here it is, let's get this done. Let's make sure everybody's happy. I mean, at the end, like, Snoop was so excited to hang out with us and meet with us. And the same with Diddy, like, both, those are the two, I think the two ones that I worked with you guys on. I mean, it was, you know, Diddy had us at parties with you guys. I mean, he was so excited to be working with the designers and wanted us around so often, both of them, that it was pleasant. It was really nice. And I haven't gotten that same experience since then.
Wow.
So credit to you two that you guys really did a great job of curating that.
All right, Nikita. Woo woo.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, what was the Diddy project? I didn't work on that one. Oh. What was the Diddy project?
Yeah.
Okay. So we, I don't know if you remember this, but we, oh, that's funny. So wait, you guys, I thought you were part of that. Muhammad. Okay,
yeah,
so that was.
I was. I think Muhammad was gone by then.
Yeah, I don't. We're not gonna talk about my GBMI exit, but yes, I wasn't there.
Let me just say this. Let me say this, because every time we say GBMI, we also have a little chuckle at the end of it, right? And so, right. You know, let me see delicately. So first of all, let me just say, Killick Data was a genius of sorts in putting GBMI together. Like, just right. Hearing that backstory of how that brand. That company came to life. It was just nothing short of genius. So let me say that. But it was also kind of like the Wild Wild West, in that, you know, he was one of those founders who just literally touched every piece of the business. And that has its pros and its cons. Let me say that. And so that's why, to the audience, that's why we always are like GBMI. Because, you know, I think what you've heard is that we were able to do some amazing things there. But it wasn't without a number of little bumps and bruises along the way.
Right.
And that's why it's funny, because it's sort of bittersweet, you know.
Right.
We could do what we wanted, go. I knew I was in the right place when I walked into the conference room to go, you know, when I met Killick for my interview. And halfway through it, he got up and he looked at John Lewis. He said, "Oh, just pay her whatever she wants," and left. So that's when I knew I was in the right place. But little did I know what that was going to cost me later. But anyway.
Right.
So that's our GBMI, little background for everybody.
Well, let me jump back on the Diddy part. So I think I thought you were involved in that, Muhammad, because I think I saw you out at the, remember there was the there was a party that he had after one of the, I don't know, to the Oscars or something. And I bumped into you out at that party in New York. So I think I was at the party,
but I might not have been to GBMI.
I remember seeing you in line, and I was like, "Oh, cool!" Like, I don't think I had realized you had left the company at this point. So I was like, "Oh, great!" So we actually had Sean John, and for about a year,
we
created this line, and you name it, did all the back work.
It never came to fruition, though.
Never happened. The company shut down right as we were about to release the shoes. It was really disappointing, because we spent almost a whole year creating a line, working with him every day. And then literally, from my side, we showed up to the office one day, because Killick, the owner, had sold the company to a bigger corporation because of his, I don't know if you guys remember, he had some problems personally, and then walked away from the company for about a year. So then the company struggled, so he needed money. So he ended up selling it, but staying on as the CEO. And one day we all show up at the office, and that company he had sold it to just decided to shut it down. There were literally chains on the doors. So.
Wow. Yeah, I think I was gone by that point too, the chains on the doors. But maybe
crazy.
Just barely though, like just barely before. I think it was maybe like, I was gone for maybe 3 weeks, and then I got a call from Sydney. Remember Sid?
Yeah.
And you know, she told me kind of what was going down. But yeah, that's a movie we could totally write, guys.
Absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely. So yeah, sorry to go off on a tangent there.
No, that's good. Good. So talk to me about Anta. What are you doing now?
Okay.
And what's so special about this place in your life where you are right now?
So I would say unique and special at the same time. So I was the head of design at Puma, which, you know, first off, that doesn't happen very often for a Black designer. So what an opportunity they gave me there. And I was really excited. I was the head of design for the US office. They obviously have the Germany office. Head of footwear design. And at
did
the
you
time,
work on
Anta
Rihanna?
It was technically under me. I did not. One of my designers did, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, it was under my management, I would say. But no, I was not the right person at the time. We had this guy, Gersti Eugene, who was perfect to be working on some of that stuff. But yeah, that was amazing at Puma. I could tell you about Puma, too. That was amazing. Okay. We got to launch the basketball line and go down and pitch the Jay-Z to convince him to sign with Puma. So...
Yeah, I saw that on your resume. I'm like, wait, what? He was what? Okay, okay. Give me a little bit more on that.
Well, let me touch on that real quick.
Yeah,
because I didn't realize Jay-Z was with Puma.
Okay, this is awesome, actually. I think this is a great story. So we were running and training and anything that was in the U.S. office, but Puma hadn't had basketball for 20 years. So we have a whole team, and my team was almost the same team I have now. I mean, at least was a very diverse team. A lot of Black people, it was just a very, very diverse team. And we were like, we need to, like, this is the right time to do basketball again. The whole office was actually at Puma was fairly diverse. I was impressed with, like, walking in. I didn't expect that. I expected more of a Euro feel. And it was very diverse. So we were like, this is a great time to launch it, but it was the designers really pushing it because we didn't have the PLMs or the developers or any of the business side of that wasn't as diverse. So we went ahead and made some samples, and one of the trade shows, whatever it is, we showed some of the shoes to the CEO, Bjorn, and we said, hey, we think we need to launch basketball. And he said, you know, I think it's a great time. I see what you're doing. Let's go pitch it to the North American team, which is it. So I don't know if you know, Puma is separated into two offices or two buildings. So there was like North America, which is like the sales guys, and then the creative side, which is marketing design, was a whole different building. Mm-hmm. So we're in Germany, and I pitched to those guys. I did a full-on pitch and about doing basketball and the whole thing, and they all the sales guys and everybody were at this big table outside Bjorn, the CEO's office. And they're all like, yeah, like we definitely want to do basketball again, but we got to do it right. So what's your idea? Like, how do you think we launch it? So this is where I looked at my boss at the time, who was a Black lady, this lady, Karen. I looked at her like, can I say it? You know, and she, yeah, no, Karen Baus. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah. She's the one that hired me to be head of design. So I was like, all right, Karen. So I looked at her like, can I say my ideas? And she, you know, gave me the nod, like, go for it, you know? So I just said, like, I don't think we need to go the traditional basketball route, like AAU and trying to sign college teams and all that. I said, that's not Puma. That's not the way to do it. You know, I was like, I think what we need to do is go after the culture. I was like, we need to be the party. We need to be like the cool location where everybody wants to come to us, not we have to ask them to come to us. Mm-hmm. So I said, I think we need to sign a creative director. And they were like, oh, okay, a creative director. And I was like, kind of like the way we're using Rihanna, you know? And they were like, okay, like who are your ideas? So I had two ideas lined up. The first idea I said is, I said, this is the big idea. You know, keep in mind, I'm in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I said, and this is in 2016, January. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that exact date. Mm-hmm. I said, we should sign Barack Obama. He had just
won.
Wait,
what?
This was post his presidency, right?
He did it over.
In November, yeah.
Right.
Right. So it was actually January, so it was right when the transition happened.
Yes, okay. Oh my God.
I gave the full pitch. I said, listen, I said, if you have Barack, I was like, everybody's going to want to go there. Like,
The
whole country, at least 50% and the right 50%. I was like, everybody, I'll make him the GM, make him, you know, make him the business side. All he needs to do is shake some hands,
right,
you know, and
right.
say I'm associated with Puma. Completely deaf ears. I mean, everyone was just like mouths open, super quiet. Yeah. Like, and they were like, what's your second idea? And I was like, well, still in the same vein, I was like, we need the king of culture. I was like, what if we sign Jay-Z to be the GM? not do a shoot for him, but what if he signed to be a GM? Mm-hmm. And everybody's looking around at each other, and they were like, yeah, we can do that. Let's sign mm-hmm. Jay-Z. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, really? So then, so this is in Germany. So they tell me to go back, put together a presentation, and they're going to set it up so we can go meet with Jay-Z and his team and go pitch to him in New York. So I'm working the whole next week with the team, with brainstorming, putting stuff together. And then they fly me, the head of marketing, and the CEO. We go down to New York to go meet with Jay-Z. And the same thing, they give him a whole pitch. They talk about who Puma is, what Puma basketball used to be, all that stuff. And then when we're done doing, and I kind of show some random sketches that I had been working on, not a full pitch of basketball, but like, hey, we're trying to do basketball, you know, and he was like, stuff's okay, nothing special. Mm-hmm. But then he starts to talk and he says, listen, I don't need the money you guys are offering me. Like, I got money. Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm going to get into this, I want to change the game. Mm-hmm. I want to, you know, he's like, we have the talent, the sports agency, yeah. and we, you know, we work with all the athletes, and these brands don't treat the basketball play is the way they should be treated. And he gave us a few stories about like Kevin Durant not getting treated right, mm-hmm. A couple of different people. And he's like, and these are top tier people. He's like, the lower level guys definitely don't get treated right. He's like, so if you guys want to sign me and you want me to be a part of this, step number one is you need to buy me a jet. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to pick up these low level basketball players, not low level, but not the top guys, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to pick them up. I'm going to pick up their moms. I'm going to pick up all their friends, and I'm going to treat them right. And that'll change the face of Puma to all these basketball players. It'll let them all know, like, how we're going to do it for you going forward. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, I'm like, he just said buy a jet, so this deal's over.
Right.
So we walk out. They say, let's, you know, a couple of guys are going to stand there and talk, and me and the CEO and the marketing guy walk out, and the CEO, Bjorn, looks at me and says, what do you think? And I'm like, well, you know, but I'm thinking, you know, he just said buy a jet. So I'm like, yeah, no, of course. I mean, it's Jay-Z. I love everything he said. You know, and he's like, yeah. He's like, how much do you think a jet would get? Would cost? And I was like, what? And he's like, let's get him a jet. Let's do it.
Right.
And I was like,
Sean, stop.
I was like, we're buying a jet for Jay-Z. So then even cooler, one of the guys who has worked with me, another brother, this Aston Davis, he got to design the jet.
So
he designed the jet. He got to do the whole exterior of the jet, the whole thing. So when you see that jet, that was done by Aston Davis. Like, we got to do the whole, yeah. And these are guys also who are on my team now, like Gersey, Aston, France, all these guys. That's my team I have right now also.
Wait, so did the thing happen? Did the deal happen? Was Jay-Z the GM?
Oh, it happened. Yeah. So they signed. So Jay, he does is he basically is the GM. So he goes out and he signs, and he's in full control. He says, this is what basketball is going to do. So he's the one that's narrating the kind of how Puma basketball is. So like even the designs, everything we were doing, it was kind of like it all had to run through him. And he's the one that got, but I mean, all of it. So he got, just forget his name. Who's the rapper that just died a few years ago? I don't know why I'm blanking on his name.
Oh, from LA.
From LA.
Nipsey Hussle.
So if you see the last Nipsey Hussle video he was in, Nipsey Hussle brings him, he's on the Puma jet, and he brings his mom on the behind or on the jet with him, right behind him in the seat. Like, it was those guys are doing a good job, I think, of getting into the culture, like Jay-Z and his team. I think that's
is he still the GM? Them.
I think so, yeah. I think we signed a 5-year deal, and I think it's maybe been 5 years now, so it may be right towards the end.
Nikita, but like, you know, he didn't want to be the face of it.
No, Muhammad, I'm hearing it for the first time on the Soul Chronicles.
I'm like the audience. I'm like, oh my God, this is like amazing. What? Oh,
this is brilliant.
Unbelievable.
Sean, I mean, you have had such a dynamic career. I mean, this just speaks so much to you just being able to be a big thinker, right? And to be able to see these ideas to fruition. I mean, that's really what we want to highlight. That is just, and then for a brand like Puma, right? And getting them into basketball, they weren't even in basketball. I mean, I think what I used to remember about Puma basketball was Ralph Sampson.
Like, yeah. That's definitely old school.
Old school, that's all I knew about Puma basketball. And then I knew that Ralph Sampson was Indy Irie's dad, I think, right? And so, you know, that's that. The fact that you were able to have an idea, you know what? We should be in basketball. And then because of your education, right? Because you'd worked on the business side, you could put a plan together.
Right, right.
A proposal, right? To present that to the CEO and then put something in place that today is still standing. I mean, I just think, you know, kudos and hats off to you. Mm-hmm. Manamita, wouldn't you agree?
I mean, I'm still just mouth open. I'm like, this is just so
You're back on the jet. I already know you. You are trying to find pictures of that jet right now. I know how you
I'm just
work.
Like, you know what it is? Because like to be able to kind of like pitch this kind of concept, you have to have like a certain amount of legitimacy in the brand. Of course, you had a high ranking position, Sean, but you know what I mean? To be in Germany, for them to hear you out, take you serious, I mean, that just like says so much about who you are as a person, just outside of just design, who you are as a professional. And then to see it executed, you know, like that is just amazing. I mean, we know what it's like to kind of have some of those crazy ideas and someone at the brand co-sign it and then it happens and it comes to life. So, you know, it's just amazing on your list of accomplishments, you know, as an industry professional. So definitely, definitely kudos, like just amazing.
Well, you know, thank you. I'll take all compliments.
Yes.
I appreciate that. But I would more say it was, I always give credit to Puma because they were very receptive to someone who, you know, I mean, I'm just, I'm no one special, but they were really, their ears were open and executed. And, you know, like there are certain brands, I think even as designers, we are always navigating this because you guys were talking about that in one of your other episodes where you said, I think you were trying to do the Diddy run, you called it, the Diddy runs the city.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying you had to put together a PowerPoint presentation to convince them that the running team, that this was a good idea.
Yeah.
And you were like, this is, you know, bullshit, BS, right? Like, mm-hmm. And that's what we have to deal with pretty much in every project every day corporately that frustrates us. So when we find a company that is open to ideas and they want to hear everything, that type of an environment, I think a lot of people gravitate towards that. And that's definitely, I don't know how they are now. I haven't been there in a few years, but that's how Puma was then. It was a very open conversation environment. Wow. And maybe that was Karen Baus who set it up in our group that, you know, anybody's ideas are listened to and it's very, you know, like we'll give it a chance, mm-hmm. you know, but it was a good environment. I would say that where I felt
Yeah, I would definitely, I would, I don't even know Karen Baus. I never met her, but just based on everything I've heard, I would definitely say it was because of her.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I agree.
There's no 3, 4, 5 ways around it. And that is also, people, why we need more people of color, particularly more African-Americans in these roles, because they are bringing another type of sensitivity. And I don't mean sensitivity from a feeling standpoint, but I mean that they're sensitive to what's happening, not just in the culture, I mean, because that's the obvious place to go, but sensitive to what's happening in business, sensitive to what the trends might be, sensitive to what, you know, they oftentimes had a lot of experience putting these things together.
Right.
And they're also sensitive to bringing people along. And not everybody, I will say, is like that. You know, a lot of people hear a good idea, they snatch it, go run it, and regurgitate it as their own.
Yeah.
But because a lot of us have been in those situations, we're very sensitive not to do that and to want to bring others along with us. So I don't know, Karen, and you can sue me later, but I'm going to say she's the reason.
I agree, 100%.
Yeah, because I was paying attention to that. Sean, at Nike, Nikita was my boss, and she was one of those people who gave me full license to bring all the wild, crazy-ass ideas I was coming with. You know what I mean? And I think it's like when you have a certain person who, when you say sensitive, it's sensitive to your team, sensitive to their strengths, and you know what I mean? So yeah, that's so true. And I could imagine if anyone else maybe had been, you know, in the leadership role, they would have been like, girl, you're crazy.
They would have been shut down on site. I mean, the minute he said Barack Obama, they would have been like, so this was great. You know, thanks for coming. Close the door on your way out, right? Please, we've been there. And sometimes I think this too, because I mean, I think this might provide some sort of soothing balm for some people listening. The reason, why do people do that? Why do people shut down way out there, blue sky ideas, particularly people who are saying they want to be on the edge, right? People who are saying they want to innovate, but then they'll shut down these really crazy ideas. It's because they themselves can't imagine doing it. It's not something that they could ever see themselves doing. So if I can't do it, then surely you can't.
Right.
Right. And so that's why you can't stop.
Yeah.
That's why you have to get your crazy idea out there.
Yeah.
Because the only reason it's being shut down is because you're talking to very limited people. Mm-hmm. You're talking to people with, I mean, what I mean to say is limiting beliefs. Mm-hmm. You're right. Talking to people who don't believe in their own greatness, or maybe they don't have any. I mean, I don't want to pretend that everybody's great, you know, so you have to keep pushing your idea. You have to keep pushing your movie. You got to push your clothing idea. If you have a new product, you've got to keep pushing it until you make it a reality.
Yeah.
So that's just my little two seconds.
I agree 100% with that.
So I really want to get to answer. And I'm so glad we've taken all these back roads, because I know that Muhammad is still figuring out A, the jet, B, where is it now, and C, can it come pick me up in Ghana? Like. So I'm glad we've taken some of the twists and turns, but I want people to know what you're doing right now. I want to hear about this group of people, this very diverse group of designers that you've put together, and I want to hear what your goals are for the future.
Yeah, wow, great and deep questions there. Okay, so yeah, I'm with Anta. They are, keep in mind, I didn't really know much about them either right when they were recruiting me. But they're very successful. They're like the Nike of China. And if you keep in mind, you know, Nike is global, but the US only has 328 million people, where China has 1.4 billion. So if they're the Nike of China, they have a pretty good handle on a consumer base. So they are very profitable. Let me just say that, because they're like a vertical company. They have their own retail stores, and they have their own factories. And to put in scale the amount of retail stores they have in China, I heard this number that like Foot Locker has about 4,500 global retail stores, Foot Locker. Anta has about 15,000 Anta stores in China.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah. So as a vertical model, they make about, if Nike in the end of, these are numbers I've heard, I'm not a numbers guy, but I just remember these because they were so impactful. If Nike makes profit at the end of the day, about $1 per shoe that they sell or create, right? Anta makes about $10 per profit per shoe. So they do a good job financially, great vertical model. So yeah, anyway, so that's the company, Anta, that was recruiting. They were trying to buy Puma while I was there. And then I got recruited out of Puma, which I'm in a great situation. I just told you the Jay-Z story. My boss is a black lady who believed in me. You know, I'm in a great situation, you know. And they basically recruited me out and said, you know, they told me all that stuff. They said they were trying to buy Puma. So they were like, you may be still part of Puma when this is all done, but we'll pay you better. Mm-hmm. And you can live in California. Mm-hmm. And we're going to launch Anta globally. And we want to open a U.S. office in California. Mm-hmm. So it'll be like a headquarters, kind of like Puma has a headquarters. Mm-hmm. Adidas has a headquarters over here. They're like, we're going to open a headquarters, like a phenomenal headquarters, but in Venice Beach. Mm. You know, and I was, you know, crossed my eyes, and they were like, and you
were so stoked. You didn't know what to
do. Oh, and they were like, and at the time they recruited me in as like the creative director, and they said, but you have 22 designers you can bring in to build your staff, you know. So it was like, I was like, really? Like, this is amazing. Like, I'm gonna, you know, build this from scratch, and maybe we can build it properly. Not that Puma wasn't properly, but it was like, cool. I love the underdog story. I love building things from scratch. It's really exciting to be part of that journey. So yeah, so that was the original pitch that got me to leave. So I kind of walked away, and then within the first year, the guy who was my boss, who he was the GM of all of this whole launch, he resigned and went to Brand Curry, and they made me the basically the GM of the entire headquarters that they were trying to build. So I get to be basically in charge of everything. It's like, you would have been, I'm in charge of sales, I'm in charge of marketing, I'm in charge of design. And I was like, you know, I was blown away. I was like, this is amazing. Unfortunately, about 2 months after that, they decided to buy a company called Amer Sports, which is like Wilson. Amer Sports owns Wilson, Arteryx, Salomon. They own a bunch of brands like that. So they bought that company, invested there instead of launching Anta in the US. Yeah. So they decided to not open this global headquarters, but we had already signed the deal on the location, the whole deal. Like they pulled out of everything and said, let's put that on pause for like 4 or 5 years until we can make sure Amherst Sports is going. So yeah, so long story short, I had brought in about, I think we have 8 guys. I brought in 8 guys and I was on my way to try to get to the 22 and then was preparing to figure out how to run a whole corporate office, you know, when they kind of pulled it all out from underneath us, but said, let's just open a design studio for now. Mm-hmm. And you guys can, you know, work with the China team and you guys can be our design studio and we'll figure things out from there. Mm-hmm. So that's the business side. That's the negative part or the journey that I went on to get to where we are now. Mm-hmm. However, now I get to talk about like the team and what we've been able to do since being there. Yeah. I think that's kind of really cool. It's because we're stuck in this kind of limbo situation. And cut me off whenever I'm.
No, this is great. Just keep going. Okay. No, this is wonderful.
Okay. So now we're in this situation after about a year of being here where you have these designers. We have no support system around us. We're just 8 designers sitting in an office in Santa Monica or design studio. So what we did is I just was like, well, let's go after it. Let's do it. So we signed the lease on the new office. I let the guys design the office. So we built and designed the entire office. We brought in an artist, this guy, Taz Rock. He came in and he did these amazing live paintings, but out of like spray can. He's a graffiti artist, but he did all these really cool paintings in there. The guys fully designed the office. So it's like an art studio or an art walk. Cultural center is basically the idea of what it was. Because what we were saying was we still have, Anta still has U.S., partners such as we have Rajon Rondo, we have Clay Thompson, we have, you know, they're always trying to sign people. We Salehi is a new guy they had just worked with this past year. So we needed a cultural center. So I let all the guys design it. We actually physically built it. Like we actually went in with, like, you know, we went to the hardware store and built this whole studio. So it's the team's studio, which is really cool. And then we just have been off and designing and creating, and we've been moved all over the company because we're designing for China now while we're kind of in pause waiting to launch in the US. And the guys are basically, we are kind of, the team kind of split where we do like future concepts and then we do inline stuff. So it's like, that's how we're learning how to work with the China team so that the day we launch, we'll be that much more experienced with working with this company, I guess. But the team is amazing. It's the best team I've ever worked with. Some of the guys are from the Puma team that I had over there. Some of the driving force behind it. So this guy, Gersi Eugene, Frant, always gets troubled with his last name. It's like Mondesoa, Aston Davis. You remember Jeff Dees, Nikita? From?
Oh, yeah. I remember Jeff. For sure.
Jeff's the creative director. Jeff and I went to college together. We knew each other before college. When I was at my other college, we were friends. And then we've worked at GBMI. We've worked at a couple of K-Swiss together. We've been at a couple of different companies together. So he's like my number two here. But yeah, we just have the coolest culture. It's all super creative. We push each other every day. It's very open environment. And we're basically sitting and designing and killing it.
So just to reground on Anta, so it's a Chinese-based company. You're designing all the sneakers for them. You're based here in LA with your team of 8 designers, 6 of whom are African-American, which is just unheard of. What's next for you and for that team?
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of just kind of waiting and what we're doing is we're training. I would say like, I look at, I'm an athlete originally, right? So I always look at it as training. So I feel like we're kind of in the off season, even though we're learning their systems and drawing for them. Excuse me. But what we're doing is we're learning new like design techniques and putting together strategies for how we can really like what our next big steps are. So like we've launched an Instagram page called The Loft. It's like the_loft_LA. And that's where we put all of our like sketches on and all of our when we're training and stuff like that, you see like all of us, we're trying to be transparent. Okay. As long as it's not a project for Anta that they're currently working on, whether it was dropped or just a casual sketch on the side or, so all the work we're doing for that, we just put together and we just like opened the page up one day And I think today we may be hitting, it's only been like 3 months and we're at like 6,000 followers on that Instagram page. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. We're like, and I think it's because we're actual designers and on Instagram and we're showing our stuff, which when I say Anta treats us well, they don't care. They're like, as long as it's not a project that we're, that we have in line that we're working on. Yeah. Like, you know, share with the world, let them see the cool stuff you guys are doing. So that's one of the things we're doing. The other thing is we're just really like upping our game as designers. So we are really like learning new programs, pushing technology, trying to figure out how we can like advance kind of ourselves as, you know, being a Black designer in the industry. First off, you have to be, at least from our point of view, you have to be more talented than everybody else. Mm-hmm. You have to be better. You have to be. So at least that's the perspective we take to stay motivated. So we are like working hard and training and just kind of trying to be the best we can be, I guess, is the kind of, so whatever comes next, we're ready to attack, whether it's launching in the US or we're not even sure, whatever it is, we want to be there and be ready to go.
Wow. I know from my perspective, I'm excited to see what you do next. I'm so inspired by what you've already done. And I just hope that we can remain in close contact so we can be along for the ride.
Absolutely. I'm excited, and the guys are excited to even know you guys. I mean, you guys have such good contacts, and your journey is amazing. We're inspired by listening to you guys.
Good. Listen, I have this one last question, because sometimes we talk to people and they understand one aspect of the business, but like, you know, you have been all over the place. How feasible is it? I mean, I keep seeing these celebrities and, you know, they are going in-house with brands. Like, how hard is it to start their own company? Like, I'm just looking at Kanye. He's chasing these brands. He's begging them. I'm like, between him and Kim Kardashian, I'm like, can't they just have a brand? Like, what's your take on that? Like, you know, how feasible is something like that?
Listen, you're saying exactly, like, Nikita, you asked, like, what's our next thing almost? You're saying exactly what I think needs to happen next. I think, you know, there are entertainers out there. They are so connected to the culture. The brands are taking them and using them. Mm-hmm. It's a good partnership. I wouldn't say using them, partnering up with them in order to really elevate the brands. I've been saying the same thing. Like, all they need is a few people, the right supporting cast, and, you know, pick a Nikita and Muhammad, maybe some of the guys from Aloft.
Okay, Sean, this is the offline conversation. Let's talk more on this one.
Yeah.
Y'all just going to give our strategy to the world, but okay.
Oh my God. This has just been like, my brain is exploding. I feel like, you know, you listeners out there, just so much great information just about the industry, which is, you know, really this episode just kind of brings to light what we want the Soul Chronicles to be about, which is, you know, just shining a light on the industry. What happens behind the scenes? Who are the people? Who are the players? Who are the people of color who are pushing the envelope forward? And one of those people is Sean O'Shea, our guest today. So Sean, thank you so much for being a part of the Soul Chronicles.
Thanks for listening to the Soul Chronicles, the podcast navigating life and times in the sneaker industry, Hollywood, and corporate America. Be sure to join us for